Blog Talk
Greetings.
Radio.
Greetings, everyone. This is a rebroadcast of a previous show that we did on the hidden history of hemp.
Thank you.
getting into the history, so we don't want to give us too much about the time period when this, the name marijuana surfaced. But just is there a difference?
Yeah, there's a major difference. The cannabis sativa, the original name given to the hemp plant, the plant that was grown was separate from the cannabis indica plant by many years. And the European was concerned about the cannabis sativa because of the textile industries. And then in 1839, Dr. O'Shaughnessy had gone to Calcutta, India, because they had learned that the Indians had been using a smaller plant, brown plant, that had some medicinal properties. And that's when they coined cannabis indica, a different medical plant of the cannabis family. So the two different plants, to be honest with you, the USDA knows that you can't even grow a cannabis indica medicine plant right next to a field of cannabis sativa plants, because pretty soon the hemp will override it and destroy the pollen for the medical virtues of it, if that's strong. So they have to be grown in two separate fields. They're not the same. They're definitely not the same. They produce the same looking seeds, but they're completely different species. So, and that, it confused the two. Sativa, indica mix, and all of that, it's a definite different plant.
Right. So which one, have they both been around since ancient times? More of the ancient history? Tell us about the ancient history of these two plants.
Both have an ancient history, because the Kemetic people, the Egyptians, the people in Africa, not just Africa, but the Dogon also, used the plant in rites of passage in Benin, but in ancient Kemet, they used the hemp plant to weave the fibers of the mummies. And I know a lot of times they say that it was made out of flax, but the flax wouldn't have been able to go 3 to 10,000 years wrapped in the mummies, wrapping the mummies because of the salt solution. It would have dissolved the flax. That's why it's not many flax sails on the sea, the ships. The canvas, most of it is made out of hemp, but they did use the medicinal in ancient Egypt. Is it that the European is semi-new to the medicinal aspects of it because of the cold regions and the way history played it, grew in warm climate. It grew in warm climate. So, no, it's been used since ancient times. They even found buried women with bags of hashish and the afterlife. So, yeah, it's been used. But in the 20th century, they villainized it in order to cover up a lot of history with laws enacted against it as if it's a bad problem.
Right.
The law is the problem.
Tell us about, in ancient times, what the medicinal use of the plant was. Used
for?
How was it used in ancient Egypt?
And were there
other parts of the world where this was used in ancient times?
Yeah, in ancient Kemet, a lot of the midwives, even to the 20th century, 18th, 19th century, the midwives used it for women's issues because of PMS, menopause, childbirth, anything dealing with a woman's issue, that's what it was used for. Stomach cramps. The seed was used as food. So it was extensively used as an antiseptic and an anesthesia. So it's definitely got some medical efficacy. Well, now, why do they use it now? That's a whole different conversation.
Mm-hmm. So it was used in tinctures, and I know that I read some things about it being used to treat malaria.
Yes. actual anthrax poisoning. They use that in South Africa for the Daga in South Africa, which is a higher form of cannabis. So, yeah, the Dogon renowned for using cannabis, and the Dogon's language is ancient Kemetic language. A lot of the language is ancient Kemetic. So they brought the culture with them. I have an encyclopedia from 1856 where they actually say that the Africans made their clothes out of hemp and flax. That's what we made our clothes out of. So we were well affiliated with the plant. But the medicine aspect is goes far back into Egypt, Persia, the Middle East, China. So it's nothing new. It's just new. It became part of the U.S. Pharmacopoeia in the latter part of the 19th century. You know, it's kind of new, but it's still old as a medicine.
Right. And okay, so then in ancient Kemet, it had a whole variety of uses. Also, I understand in China, in ancient times and antiquity, it was used. And also, India, Native America, right here in the Americas, hemp was growing. There's an ancient history of hemp right here in America, correct?
Yes, that's correct. I was looking at some of my documents earlier, and they had a list of different plants and things that they found already growing in America, and hemp was one of them. So, you know, to say that the Europeans brought the hemp to the Western world, that's not true.
It was already here.
Exactly. You know, Kentucky was and Missouri were the two main places where they grew the best hemp, close to the Russian hemp, the Russian quality. You know, the strong hemp, because it was a cold region. And that's what they were shooting for. That's what they wanted. So, excuse me?
I was just to really touch on the ancient history of hemp in here in the Americas, what are later, of course, known as the Americas. The indigenous people here had uses of hemp. They used hemp in ceremony and medicine, clothing as well. Clothing of woven goods, rugs, and probably their teepees and other structures, building structures.
Yes.
I understand they use them in a multitude of ways as well.
Well, yeah, they had found artifacts that were weaved with hemp. In Kentucky, that the Native Americans had made long before the Christians had even come to the Americas. So it's no mistake that the Native Americans had been using it. The ancient people of Kemet, I learned that they used to make bricks out of lime, hemp herbs, and water. And hemp herbs, lime, and they used to petrify the stone, and they found a lot of ancient structures like that. Those were Egyptologists, they unearthed buildings like that. As a matter of fact, in France, they're building according to those old recipes from ancient Kemet. They just can't get enough hemp to make enough bricks to build the building.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I was reading about that. They're trying to do that construction here, but then there's so much regulation around him, which we'll get into.
Okay.
Yeah, and So the Moors also were responsible for bringing hemp to introducing hemp to Europe. We all know, not all of us, but you know, we talked a little bit about the history of the Moors and their, how they were in Spain for conquered Europe and had a flourishing empire for 700 years, and also a flourishing hemp culture.
Right. Well, here you go. Right here, the first Western paper mill was built in Spain in 1150 A.D. by the Moors. The second was built in Italy in 1276. The art of papermaking finally reached England in 1494, 2 years after they discovered America. They didn't have a printing press. And it says that some scholars attribute the illiteracy and flat world science of Western Europe to the late development of papermaking and book printing. No doubt this is true. During the Dark Middle Ages, when Europeans were still speaking in riddles and trying to decipher unreadable parchment, the Arabs were translating the works of Euclid, Ptolemy, Aristotle, Plato, and Hippocrates. The Greek classics did not find their way into Europe until the fall of Constantinople in 1453. And I've been to Istanbul, Turkey, which is, you know, old Constantinople. It's amazing the things that the Moors and Arabs were passing back and forth during that time. You know, and then the Europeans rejected everything that came from the Arabs because they considered it evil. So, you know, it's ridiculous. So, yeah, it's pretty...
They didn't exactly reject everything, but they didn't exactly credit it. They really took everything because really the Renaissance was...
But they burned their books.
They burned their books.
When they left Spain, they burned all the books that the Moors had.
That's right. That's right. You think it's just like Timbuktu. You know, all of what was going on in Europe, a lot of education was going on in Africa and Asia and North Spain. From 711 A.D. until 1492, the brothers completely dominated that area of the world. And they had already come to the New World before 1492. So, you know, it's a piece of history that has to be put back together so we can understand.
Right. Exactly, and there's a couple of documentaries surfacing on that period of history that, you know, there's quite a bit that had to be compiled because so much information was destroyed and covered up and out and out lied about. So that's fascinating. And then of course from Spain, we sort of can move to the New World the America.
That's right. They brought the culture with them, but the cultivation of it was another story, and that's where we're infused because they realized that on the west coast of Africa, a lot of the missionaries were aware that the culture was already thriving. So the only thing they had to do was transplant Africans from the African continent to the New World. And that's all they had to worry. They didn't worry about learning the culture for themselves, you know, the Europeans, because they always had the slave labor. Slave labor is what ran the hemp culture in America, you know.
Right.
It certainly did. They didn't use white labor. Seeing white labor, according to their works, seeing white labor was always avoided because that was the most expensive labor in the world. Seeing white labor. In order to get them to do it, you had to pay them a whole lot of money. Or shillings or pences to get the work, the job done. No, they didn't work. There's no way.
Right.
No way.
So that brings me to this is good, and welcome to the Ringing Stone Network. And we're what a fascinating topic today: African Americans and the lost history of hemp, or the hidden history. And so we have our guest, Daniel Davis, brother Nate, and. Let's kind of jump right into now into what we call the pre-colonial era in America, starting with, because we know the Spanish were the first to go out, and we know the Portuguese, and we know they went to the southern part of what now became South America and Central America.
Right.
But let's talk about part of America that became the United States of America and started with the British. So the British were the first quote-unquote colonies. My understanding is that Jamestown was one of the first places that you saw the cultivation of hemp starting to crop up. So let's talk a little bit about the British and the colonists and the use of and the growing of hemp.
Well, yeah, the colonies, that was a prerequisite to grow the hemp. In 1764, among some of the books that I found. And it's interesting because they tolerated things then that they wouldn't tolerate now. The act against buying land of the natives was explained. Hawkers and peddlers were regulated. A tax was imposed upon persons guilty of certain heinous crimes, and an excise laid on all wine, rum, brandy, and other spirits retailed in the province. Precautions were likewise taken against the importation of poor and impotent persons and for raising good hemp, and imposing penalties upon all who should manufacture the cordage on merchantable hemp. So if you screwed around and didn't wear your hemp, and say you grew cotton didn't matter prior to the cotton gin, prior to 1795. That was not the most important crop at all. They even encouraged people to grow hemp in flax because tobacco was a totally useless plant. It was not, you couldn't wear it, you couldn't eat it, you couldn't do much with it except smoke it. So they encouraged people to grow hemp. It was very, very important. So prior to the Revolutionary War, the hemp plant was very, very important. As a matter of fact, prior to the Revolutionary War, the first mills that went up in America were papermaking, publishing, and distributing networks. That's what they printed first because they came from Europe where they didn't have freedom of press. So the first thing they wanted to do was have freedom of press, and that's what actually got them to win the war because they were able to communicate freely about what was going on. And it's because of the freedom to have the material to make paper from a material and to print whatever you wanted. That's true freedom of press, where printing press wasn't monopolized, privately monopolized. Now it is.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about some of the uses that hemp was during the colonial time. So we mentioned paper. Were there other things that were made out of hemp?
Oh, yeah, the caulking, a lot of the caulking in the ships, they used to use that. The oil from the seed, they used to use the rope, you know, for rigging and everything. All the canvas on all the ships were made out of hemp because it was most reliable since ancient times. So, you know, they could say that they made sails out of cotton and everything else, but it wasn't long-lived. And, it was clothing, all of their clothing. And the thing of it is, the reason why they encouraged the use of hemp in pretty much everything they used is because the printing press had bounties out for rags. If you had rags or raw rope, they would pay you the better price for the better quality product. And hemp was number one. Flax was used, wool and everything, but hemp was used pretty much in everything. Everything. So as far as what they use it for, sky is the limit. You know.
Right.
You know, the paper. I think the paper. You say what?
No, go ahead. Go ahead. Continue.
No, I think the paper was one of the most important items they use it for. You know, rope and sails. But because right now, people not aware of that history of how paper went from, you know, alkaline product, which is hemp, to an acid product, which is wood pulp. You could never get an alkaline piece of paper out of acid, out of wood pulp. It'll never happen. So that's why it's so destructive. It's so destructive.
The Declaration of Independence was written on hemp paper. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. That was official paper at that time. All paper, you know, the Declaration of Independence, the newspapers, I mean, I've got newspapers from 1794 in this condition. You hold a hemp rope next to it, it looks identically the same. We're talking 222 years old. I've got books from the 16th century, and all of them in this condition. So I'm convinced myself personally that they made one of the worst mistakes in history when they went from hemp or rag paper to wood pulp. And they did it hastily in 1863. They had already experimented with wood pulp paper. They knew that wasn't the best route to go. But then when it was convenient, where they made it a permanent fixture, and we're paying that price already. People just don't know.
And we're going to get into that in 1863 and up and around the Civil War and afterwards. Thing as on my research on here, I came across a couple quotes. And one of them is by a gentleman by the name in 1777, Edward Antell. He wrote in his introduction, Observations on Raising and Dressing of Hemp. He quotes, "Hemp is one of the most profitable productions that earth furnishes in northern climates, as it employs a great number of poor people in a very advantageous manner. If its manufacture is carried on properly, it becomes worthy of serious attention of every trading man who truly loves his country." So patriotism was definitely associated with the growing and the using of hemp.
That's right. That means you are 100% right. And there's so many books written about the need and the necessity. I mean, they feel you would be foolish not to grow hemp, because how can you function without it? Those are some words. So to not encourage it now, and we'll get into why they stopped encouraging it. That's very interesting.
Founding fathers, both George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, in their own diaries, are quoted as growing hemp and in favor of hemp. In fact, I have this quote here. Jefferson believed that hemp could be a superior crop to tobacco, as you were saying, which he said exhausted the soil, used too much manure, provided no nourishment for cattle. Hemp, on the other hand, was of the first necessity to commerce and marine, would bring maritime. In other words, to the wealth and protection of the country. In 1850, Jefferson went on to, I think, he got the first patent
That's right. Yeah, he had the first patent on the first hemp rake, and they realized that it was labor intense, and who was going to do the work? Who was going to do the work? And all of a sudden, George Washington grew hemp, but George Washington physically didn't grow hemp. His slaves grew the hemp. They were the developers of it. And make no mistake, George Washington didn't grow hemp. Thomas Jefferson grew up at Monticello with George Washington. They grew up there. And where the present day Pentagon is right now was a hemp plantation. All of that was hemp.
Wow.
So, and we learned that when we went to a hemp plantation in Lexington, Kentucky, just last year. And they told us, hey, for people to believe that hemp was a drug and people were strung out on the street smoking herbs. they shouldn't even think like that. That's not the history at all that ever happened. But no, it was much encouraged to grow it. It was always encouraged to grow it up until a certain point. And then they signed.
Right. So let's get into the history of the use of Africans as slave labor to really grow the hemp. And I know you have some quotes, but before we get to the quotes, I wanted to talk about the connection between the shipping industry. At the time, the first shipping company was in Massachusetts. And I read somewhere that, of course, talk a little bit about how much hemp was used in the construction of a ship, which was the only vehicle of transportation in those times to go from one continent, one country, to another country. Could you tell me
the hemp rope and all of that was just immense. It was the rigging was that was really the most important aspect of it. You couldn't even make a voyage without the rope. You just couldn't do it. They wouldn't even try it. So the rigging was that was the most important time of maritime. And like you said, they went to West Africa to capture, steal, occupy the area to take slaves and to bring us back to work the hemp fields and to make rope, because we have rope walks, lots of rope walks. And that's what we occupy. That's what we were doing. We were making rope, you know, for the ships. And that was
and the sails were made out of hemp through the sails.
Yeah, all of the sails were made out of hemp. You couldn't sell anything else to someone except hemp sales, because they knew that would take the voyage. I mean, I've heard some people say that they made sales out of flax, but it's a very short time in history that they used it for, because it's not reliable. Flax is a good fiber, but not as strong as hemp. It's just not. So,
well, you said, I think that also the hemp was waterproof too. That was another big advantage.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's waterproof, and they had to make paper out of it, because if they had a ship that capsized, they would need the material to survive. They used the hemp seed to produce the oil for the ink, and ink they couldn't afford it to run like now. You got ink that this is not the same. So, because I've got some books that were that came out of the water, salt water, and they're in good condition. I mean, they're wrinkled and everything, but you can still read everything. I mean, they're still readable. So they had to be careful. Yeah, it is.
Right.
Because everything prior to the Civil War was a hemp culture. It was a hemp culture. It was just ridiculous to create, like they say, the king. How long was cotton king? You know, they're trying to make it seem like it was cotton was king since 1619,
right,
or whatever they want to say.
Right.
The first king.
Yes, cotton king later. It's my understanding of it. Cotton king later.
Cotton growing. I mean, even in South America, they grew cotton, you know, but the major fiber of the colonists was not cotton, because of the cotton seed. I mean, if you ever pulled cotton seed out of from the cotton, man, that's tenacious.
it's really difficult. And you can see why they worked our people to death in those fields.
Exactly. They worked us to death. And when Kentucky got its go ahead to grow the hemp because of the Blue Ridge area and the soil, they wouldn't even sell slaves outside of Kentucky. If you were born in Kentucky as a slave, they would circulate you within the range because of the knowledge of hemp production. And they didn't play that game.
No way.
Yeah. Because it was the most lucrative crop. Everybody wanted hemp. And they imported a lot of Russians. You say what?
They imported Russian hemp?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, St. Petersburg. That's the connection between the United States and Russia. They had long centuries of hemp and buying and trading. That's what Russia's all about. All of those countries in that part of the world grew hemp. It's not a secret. It's a secret now to make you think that Russia's our biggest enemy. No, the bear and the eagle always connected on hemp issues. Always.
So it's really amazing, you know, that hemp could be used for so many uses. And
101,000
different products. Right. Amazing. And then after you use it for shipbuilding and clothing and the ink that goes on the paper, if it's used, you know, from that's made from hemp and the numerous other products, then you can also consume it. That's 646-929-0691.
get into the queue for your questions and comments. And
right.
We have some callers.
We've got a caller, Nate. We're going to take a question here from a caller. Caller 443-854-4810. You're on. Go ahead, caller. Do you have a question for the guest?
Yes.
Hello?
Charlie, how are you doing? I can hear you.
Greetings. Hello?
Hello, caller. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, go ahead. Give your question. Hello? Yeah, there you go.
I hear you.
Okay. I really am. I have a question, but what I wanted to say is I've been studying him for a while, and for your listeners, I got the book, the e-book, The Emperor Has No Clothes by Jack Hellyer. I can give it to you for free for your listeners to download.
I got two copies of it.
All right, but I made several documentaries on YouTube about hemp. One of them is called Hempcrete, the Strongest Building Material in Nature. That almost got a million views. I got a hemp food, and world hunger, food shortages, and GMO. I got another one about hemp fuel. You know, I also got a friend in Colorado that I went to Hopkins with. You know, they millionaires now. They've been down there since 2009. And he's grown. He has like 36 acres of hemp. And, you know, I'm supposed to be going down there with him this year. When spring and, you know, when they start to put down the harvest or whatever to record about how they're going to do the biofuel, like show the process.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful.
And then
put it straight into a diesel engine Mercedes-Benz or a diesel engine
right.
Volkswagen. Now, this is the thing, right? Volkswagen is going through a lot of stuff right now because of what's going on with the emission thing. But the reason why Volkswagen is going through this is because Volkswagen has two cars that America just banned last year. One of them is called the XL1, Volkswagen XL1. Look it up. It's out everywhere across America, in the UK, it's in Canada, Australia. This car gets 300 miles to the gallon, and it runs on biofuel so we can grow.
That's right. You know, this is good. Maybe last year we saw those over there, and we kept saying, how can we even see a leader? Right, I didn't even know that.
And then it's another Volkswagen that's made in America. It's made in Kentucky. It's a Volkswagen Blue Motion TDI engine 1.5. This car gets 90 miles to the gallon right now. 90 miles to the gallon. This car is banned from this country, man. You feel me? We can build houses in
hempcrete.
That's right. That's right.
Hempcrete,
but that's
right.
Fireproof, waterproof, moldproof, termiteproof. I don't know if y'all familiar with the Venus Project.
Yes, I am.
Oh, yeah. Okay. The Venus Project, the whole thing about hemp is because is when we start messing with the hemp, that means that we become self-reliant. There's no more
government.
If it is a government, it's a small government. You feel what I'm saying?
That's right.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I know exactly what you're saying. So my whole thing to this is, like, at the end of the day, yo, it don't matter who you vote for. Negroes keep talking about, yo, you got to go vote. Keep telling them, yo, it don't matter who you vote for. Black people never had a right to vote. It's a privilege. You know what I'm saying? That
That's
goes to the writer's block coming up. And then secondly, America never voted for no president, white, black, Asian, Hispanic, Arabic. Never voted because the Electoral College always selects the presidents and the delegates. You know what I'm saying?
That's right.
So it's some of the most funniest stuff on the planet. But my whole thing is this, yo. Like Bob Marley always said, the only way to win the race is to stop racing. So, you know, the Venus Project is a natural-based resource economy, yo. And the number one resource on this planet other than water is hemp. And we can use hemp for plastic, biodegradable plastic, biodegradable everything. We can use it for building your cars, every Ford had a hemp car. Everything was made from hemp. The tires, the glass, hemp glass is like 100 times stronger than plexiglass.
Right.
It don't shatter, none of that stuff, man. You know, they plan without life, man. They destroying our planet on purpose, man. Like, everything that this one plant can do, man, can pretty much, like, we can, like, take this to the next level, man. Everybody be on the same playing field. You know, ain't no more working hard 40 hours plus a week and all that other extra bullshit, man. I mean, excuse my passion, but it's just,
like you said,
they're destroying all of it.
I appreciate you. Could you give us that YouTube information on that you produce? Could you get that out there?
Yeah, my YouTube page is Live Too Bad.
Live,
L-I-E-D, 2 bad, B-A-D. And just type in Live Too Bad and then type in hemp. And all my hemp, everything that I got on hemp is, you know, is in a playlist, or you can watch it, you know. But I got, I'm the one that's mostly putting all the hemp information up on the internet from like the past 8 to 9 years ago when it wasn't, nobody wasn't talking about hemp. You know,
that's
what happened after when they abolished slavery, and you know, 1863 is when they abolished slavery, and that's when they started cutting trees down literally to make paper. They needed a temporary substitute, and that's what that's where they went to. And like you said, they can make everything out of that. They can make everything out of it. And it's not, it's
actually.
Give us your name again, and maybe you
want to
give us your email, brother. So if anybody wants
to.
My name is Mike Rambo.
My email is rawjournalismqk@yahoo.com.
Say that again.
Wrong journalism. Yes, sir.
Okay. Yahoo.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, sir. And like I said,
we really appreciate you.
I appreciate y'all, man, for having this open, this open freeway for information so that people can wake up. Because, look, this is what I say, yo, before I go. If people know that it's another option than just working hard, yo, we're going to go with that option. And like I said, that's why the Indians was killed off, because what type of lifestyle would you would have had? You would have been living with the Indians, you know, living to be 100 plus, eating all organic fruits and vegetables, everybody in commerce, or work, you know what I mean, die 50, paying taxes to these Jews, these Zionists, you know what I'm saying? It's not no conspiracy theory. You know what I mean? At the end of the day, man, like, we all been effed over until we do something and hold them accountable. Nothing's going to happen, because Jesus and God ain't going to help us, man. Yeah, man, that's some real stuff, man.
If you look at how it's organized inquiry right in front of everybody.
Right. I think when we're talking about, you know, when you're talking about Satanism, it's the separation between spirit and self, you know.
Right.
You don't recognize spirit as self. So thank you for that. We've got
yes, ma'am.
Thank you,
yes, ma'am.
Thank you,
Paula.
We got your email.
We got to reach out, too.
Thank you so much. That was valuable information.
Okay.
Okay, so we've got another, we're going to take another call.
I don't have anybody in the queue, so we'll keep talking. I'll give out the phone number again. If you want to ask a question to Brother Nate Davis, our hemp historian, give us a call at 646-929-0691 and press 1 to get in the queue. So, Nate, when we last left off, we were talking about the production of the ship's transatlantic slave trade. I want to kind of keep moving here. So how many captured Africans, or what they call slaves, were needed on a hemp plantation?
Well, for example, in Kentucky, it said three slaves that was estimated to cultivate 51 acres and produce 35,700 pounds and an average of 700 pounds per acre. And they used that system, you know, throughout the South. Because once you understood the nature of the plant, they just increased it. They just increased the production. And what they don't talk about is after slavery, we continued to produce it. And the price began to escalate. The price started going up, according to the USDA. And the highest price they had to pay was, I think, 1910 or 1912. The U.S. government had to pay, and they got it from hemp farmers, and we were the producers of it. And they make note of that in the agriculture report. So it was important to have a strong body person, which was us, to do all the
right. Physical
work.
Right.
Yeah.
So that brings you kind of to the next question is. Let's talk about what you mentioned. Kentucky, you mentioned a couple of these states. So, what were the key states, you know, back in the 1800s, later part of 1700s? What were the key states that grew hemp, and how many states were growing hemp back then?
Oh, most of the states were growing hemp. I mean, Maryland, Virginia, Kentucky, Missouri became the major places because of the soil. But they grew it in Pennsylvania, of course, you know, New York, Hempstead, New York. I mean, it was, you had to grow it. I mean, there wasn't any place that didn't have hemp, some more than others. But Kentucky was the main state that they produced the hemp in because of the soil. University of Kentucky is doing experiments now. They want to see if it's feasible to make paper. It's a total waste of time. So, you know, Kentucky and Missouri were the two main states. And if you look at the Civil War history, they don't mention hemp. Kentucky very much, because you can't help but talk about hemp. So they just leave that out of the equation. They talk about it a little bit, a squirmish every now and then. But no, Kentucky was dedicated to hemp production. Right in Lexington, they have a statue of one of the generals, and right on this plaque, it talks about the hemp plantation, the hemp field. He was protecting the hemp field. You know, so they don't want to talk about it, but we were the center, the nucleus of the hemp culture, and they went peripherally outside. You know, they went outside. And they didn't really win around the world, they went outside. But the Japanese they were something else. As a matter of fact, the Japanese, the hemp culture was in Japan long before the silk culture. The Chinese brought the silk culture to Japan in the 16th century. So everybody was doing it. Everybody was doing it.
Wow. So let's get more into this Kentucky now. One of the things that I found is that in Kentucky, they call hemp the nigger crop. So what you talking about? A white man could not or would not farm hemp, and why Africans were the best at growing hemp in this country.
Well, labor. It was all about the labor, because in order to get something done, they had a choice between free white labor or slave labor. And because we played the part of the slave, that's what they relied on mostly. And we tell them, Kentucky and sometimes referred to hemp as a nigger crop, owing to a belief that no one understood its intricacies as well or was as expert in handling it as the Negro. And Lexington stated in 1836 that it was almost impossible to hire workmen to break a crop of hemp because the work was very dirty and some laborers that scarcely any white man would work at it. It was just too much work for them. And, you know, it made sense. I mean, why wouldn't you use your slaves to do it? You know. And here's something for Kentuckians. This is a book that was written in Kentucky for Kentuckians. This is called The Reign of Law, The Tale of the Kentucky Hemp Fields, dated 1900, McMillan and Company. On page 15, they have a picture of a hemp field and two black men in straw hats cutting them with a hemp, you know, cutting hemp. And on the page preceding this picture, it says, "And now, some morning at the corner of the field stand a black man with the hooks of whetstones. The hook, a keen straight blade bent at right angles to the hand or 2 feet from the hand. But these men be the strongest. No weakling can handle the hemp and seed to feed again." If everybody knew, the weakling was the white man. He couldn't handle it. It was just too much work. It was this tough. I can't do it.
Right.
I can't do it. So we knew everything about that plant from hemp from seed to seed again. You know, meaning put it in soil, it grows to a seed, you know, a luscious female plant, get the seeds and grow it again. We knew everything about it. So they destroyed a culture because we were involved with it for thousands of years. And the USDA knows that. It's just that we don't know it. And to
right.
Get back on that, because we don't know about it, 100 years of lynching with hemp ropes created exactly what we have now. It's a historical lobotomy. We have no connection with what took place. We ran so far from what we were doing, we didn't realize that we had the most valuable part right in our own hands.
So we grew the hemp, and they lynched us with the hemp rope that we made by our own hands.
Exactly. And a lot of those farmers knew that. They knew that. They lynched us. They castrated us. They, you know, did things to us that, you know, you know, all the things that took place, you know, it had everything to do with their hemp rope. They could not control the hemp plant after slavery was abolished. They know that. It was a finished deal, you know. And they went on and tried to go around it, and I guess they got their break in 1937, you know,
right.
In the 30s, when they created this whole tough reef of madness.
Right.
I have a question, though. I've got a couple of questions. One is, after Reconstruction, and say the 1900s, blacks in Kentucky and maybe some other states that were where hemp farms were still producing hemp, were still working those farms. Were they working those farms as in slaves? Okay, because I came across pictures of 1900s and they were labeled slaves working the hemp farms in Kentucky. And this was definitely, you know, after 1865, 30 years, 40 years later.
They still had some of us in bondage.
Yeah, because, you know, when Abraham Lincoln abolished slavery, they made certain clauses. I mean, you had a son that was born at a certain date, he would be a slave to a certain point, and then his son would be a slave, and he had somebody. They had all kinds of stipulations, so they specifically used that labor to continue their hemp production. Oh, yeah, it's definitely, it was still slave labor. Then I think Mississippi had its last slave code in 1995. It went all the way up into the 20th century.
Wow.
They were that dependent on our labor. I mean,
Exactly.
You know, so that's what I said. It's coming back to haunt us all now because they don't know what to do. You know, except keep it illegal and to scare people. You know.
Right.
But the first crop of hemp in Kentucky was raised by Dr. Archibald McNeil near Danville in 1775. And that was the place. That was the place. So they never thought we'd get here, but this is where we are. And it's crazy. And again, a lot of this information is out of the agriculture report, and it was written as truth because they didn't know that we'd be here. You know, I mean. They tell you in the 1913 edition of the Agriculture Report, USDA, that Hiroshima was where they grew their best hemp. So you can tell me it was just coincidental that we went there and we bombed the place. No, that's why.
That's right.
I have friends from Kentucky. I mean, from Hiroshima, and they knew all about it. You know, ancient agriculture. You know,
right.
So yeah, that's why they want to keep it villainized. Because they keep lying to people. They believe that, you know, this stuff was always bad. It had no good efficacy. It had no good history.
No, it's got all, with me, it's got all good history.
I mean, you can make 100 or 1,000 different products out of. We're stupid, careless, ignorant not to use something like that, you know.
Right.
Unless you got another agenda.
Right.
And we're going to
And I would say anybody who has another agenda, well, you know, they might be anti-cannabis. They have a different agenda. They have the same agenda as Nebuchadnezzar or anybody who is against nature, who's against feminine
viability.
That's nature.
That's right.
You know, that's my thought on that.
Well, that's what genetic engineering, that's what GMOs is about. It's against nature. But we talked the other day. I want you to read for our listening audience when we had talked about the what it would cost for them
for a slave
free labor versus slave. And I want you to break that down so people begin to understand how we were used and abused and ripped off.
Yeah. Here we go. That was out of Political Economy is Applicable to the United States by a Southern Planter, and on page 200, they talk about slavery, and it was the most important, it was so important to them. So here we go, page 201, these laborers, talking about the slaves, these laborers ensure and perpetuate themselves and are guaranteed to the country and their immediate owners by the most sacred and fundamental laws of the nation. No free labor can compete with them. The free labor must have wages that will bear the irregularities incident to all labor, such as occasional relaxation, illness, whims, changes, and dissipations. For free laborers are in families, and useless mouths are to be fed. Houses, rents, furniture, taxes, doctor bills, all amounting to some style, and a considerable amount have to be sustained. And they say here, the average wages or price of labor in the United States is 40 cents a day. That's white labor. In England, 2 shillings, and on the continent of Europe, is about 25 cents. As far as minute inquiries go, the above rates are correct. A slave consumes in meat 200 pounds of bacon or pork, costing in Kentucky, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Missouri, Tennessee, and Western Virginia $8, 13 bushels of Indian corn, costing $2, this makes up his food. Now for salt and medicine, add $1. And it runs thus, a year's food is $11. Their clothing is of cottons, 15 yards of wool, $1.50, 10 yards of linsey, $4, one blanket, $2, one pair of shoes, $1, making $7.50. Now this sum of $18.50
say $20 to ride it a month, the working days are 6 cents. This is not fancy, but every day's practice. So the wages of a slave is 1/6 part of the wages of free laborers. If slave labor, bring it up to date, if slave labor, therefore, was organized to the best advantages, no free labor could stand against it. I have shown before how well fitted slaves are for manufacturing and how confidential and trusted. The staples produced in this country by slaves, say cotton, sugar, rice, tobacco, and hemp, that would have no existence without it. And they know that. They've known it for centuries. But we don't know that. They spent $20 a year to run a slave. They got away with bloody murder.
It was literally oftentimes bloody murder. And the greatest act of terrorism committed against a people in the history of the world, it's very unsettling that this country has never made things right to its first people, because that's who we are.
We're the original stock of the human race.
They don't want
to recognize that, and it's coming to fruition.
Well, not just there's a secured market,
where's the security? I mean, Colorado is legal. Washington is legal. People are still being incarcerated all over the country. So where's the security? Now, that was my question. Bear with me. I want to read something, Chief Wolf. Okay, the law, Title 21 United States Code, Controlled Substances Act, Section 885, burden of proof and liabilities, exemptions and exceptions, presumptions and simple possession offenses. It shall not be necessary for the United States to negative any exemption or exception set forth in this subchapter in any complaint, any information, any indictment, or other pleadings, or in any trial, hearing, or other proceedings under this subchapter, and the burden of going forward with respect to any such exemption shall be upon the person who claims its benefit. Now, that's one piece of the law.
Right.
Everybody on this call, I'm pretty sure they consider themselves law-abiding citizens. I'm pretty sure they do. And the
right.
most famous law book that they have is the Bible. But where's the Black's Law Dictionary? Where's the Bouvier Dictionary? Where's the language of the law that we're not teaching our people that they're utilizing against us? Break. Before I go further. Hold on. Before I go further, I want to read you one more thing. Federal documents. Regulatory certifications. Certain provisions of federal law and executive orders specified below require agencies to assess how their rules might impact the economy, small businesses, and the states. Hereafter, in this document, these provisions will be referred to collectively as certification provisions. DEA has conducted these certifications. However, before discussing the economics, the nature of this rule should be reiterated. This rule revises the wording of the DEA regulations to understand of long, the DEA regulations to clarify for the public the agency's understanding of long-standing federal law. In other words, through this rule, DEA is implementing what it believes to be the mandate of Congress under the Controlled Substances Act. This mandate is that every substance containing THC be listed in Schedule 1 unless the substance is specifically exempted from control or listed in another schedule, regardless of how this rule might impact the economy, small businesses, or states. The DEA must carry out the mandate. As a result of the exemptions issued by the DEA under the interim rule, all hemp products that do not cause THC to enter the human body are entirely exempted from control, regardless of their THC content. Thus, items such as hemp, clothing, industrial solvents, personal care products, animal feed mixtures, and are considered non-controlled substance, not subject to any of the controlled substance requirements, regardless of the THC content. Further goes on to talk about other things, and it says, accordingly, for purposes of calculating the economic impact of these rules, DEA has assumed THC-containing hemp foods and beverages are lawful products under this rule. So there's language that we're not teaching people.
Right.
If people would log on to www.gamphace.com, you'll see how a black man stood in the courtroom and basically explained to the judge who he was, and you all can see the outcome. I've been here since 2011. I'm an exemption. I'm removed from the suspected class. I contract for farmers to grow. If any court has any questions, they got to call the IRS.
Wow, to grow industrial hemp.
To grow industrial hemp, where THC content doesn't matter. Have a closed loop network, lawfully obtained, federally approved. Everybody gets caught up in all the legalities and forget about the lawful things.
Wow.
Right.
And that is so important. That is, I'm glad you called in because I didn't know that. That's why they have this broad talk radio.
Well, I want to. There's a couple of things.
Yeah.
Marijuana Tax Act of 1937. They basically, my understanding is, to get this law passed, they did an end around the Constitution. And they did that by, as you say, disguising cannabis production as a revenue measure instead of going into a food and drug or commerce or textile committee. So the Marijuana Tax Act was submitted to the Ways and Means Committee, and therefore they found the end around by going through the Revenue Department when it should have gone through the Food, Drug, Agriculture Department.
Why should it have?
I said it was a straight up conspiracy.
Well, it wasn't even a conspiracy.
What I'm saying is that there were pressures by the DuPont Corporation. There were pressures to make hemp illegal and to criminalize it because the DuPonts introduced petroleum-based fibers into crush the hemp industry.
Hemp industry, 1937, they got their patent the same year. So to say that it wasn't a conspiracy, I would disagree. It was a major conspiracy.
Okay, so every time each one of you utilize the word marijuana, you're participating in white supremacy.
You're
participating in promoting an illegal, dangerous substance.
I agree with you.
That's a curse word.
Marijuana is a curse word because that was never used in the past before the 30s.
It wasn't used. The language in the law, marijuana is considered a commercial crime, period.
Right.
It's a commercial. Marijuana?
You can buy right now in the health food store, right now. And I won't, you go right now into a store and you can buy CBD oil from him. It comes from Europe, but it's sold here in the United States because the THC level is less than 1%.
Again, marijuana is an illegal, dangerous substance. In 2008, when I was in Denver, Colorado, they weren't even talking about CBD oil. They weren't talking about bringing it out to the market, so they found out a way to capitalize it. Oh, CBD. One of the top scientists that I know says, it's going to run for a little while, but you have to have full spectrum. You can't just keep selling CBD to people. Well, they're going to make as much money as they can right now. But it's the full spectrum. Before there was CBD, there was THC. There was THCV, there's THC acid, there's CBD. There's so many different compounds, but all they need to do is figure out how can we profit? How can we profit?
Profit, brother.
I agree with you.
I'm sorry?
No, but the question is how do we?
I'm trying to help the people. I'm not sitting here trying to sugarcoat anything. While you all keep reaching for the future, you're wasting time because we're already here, been here. State of New Jersey. I had to make sure the CEO of the state acknowledged the business. And he did. Go to a webpage. You'll see it. I had to make sure the CEO of my city acknowledged the business. We're here for research and development. We get to study from the seed to the stem, every bit of the plant. Whether you want to believe it, the facts are there. I'm here only here for facts. That's it. I'm here for facts. I'm talking about security. Nobody on this station yet is talking about it. We all know it's written. It's written what the plant has done. But there's also things that man has done. It's not our activities. It's our accomplishments is what gets you through the system that continues to enslave us. And then, like I said, you go to the webpage, you'll see there are people who've shown up to courtroom with gang face paperwork and got their marijuana cases dismissed. There's gentlemen who have felony cases that show up with their marijuana papers and got them dismissed because the truth, they can't run from.
If people on the listening audience, how can they contact you and how can you?
Yeah.
Today's.com. This is what you want to this is what you want to understand. I didn't want to call in because it doesn't matter unless you get into the courtroom or we mind our business and we work. That's the only way. I reached out to the medical marijuana world 3 years ago, and they said it wasn't fair that I had the exemption. I'm not looking for fairness. I'm looking to help humanity. So if you want to get with us, you go to GameFace.com. You can see what you have to understand. What you have to understand that I am your brother. I've been here asking a lot of people, my city, everybody. I have all the proper documents, but I made some accomplishments along the way. I'm not here to cater to nobody. I'm here to help people. I pay my taxes and I keep it moving, and I want to help people. So you need to go to GameFace.com, and you need reach out to the evening. Watch all the videos. Watch every night. There's not too many, but watch. Look at the accomplishments. Then you call my city. You ask the reverend, why didn't he help me? You ask the prosecutor who sat with me for 2 hours when she only said she had 30 minutes. Why she didn't help me 2 years ago. You ask them why they got me going to these courtrooms trying to prosecute members of my business just so I can waste my time to have these cases dismissed over and over again. The people need to wake up. Before Eric Holder resigned, I was down in D.C. and the video was there. Everything was there. And it didn't start.
Okay, thank you. Can you give us your website again and just spell it out so that we have your website?
Right. When we hear your frustration, though.
I'm passionate, and I'm really hoping that you all grasp this, because when I say I'm going through every avenue, it didn't start with me. It started in Oakland, California on a federal hemp business.
Just your website. Go ahead.
GamePace. That's GameFace.
GamePace.com.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
So you're saying GamePace, like your face?
GamePace. Game plan, attitude, motivation, pride, hunger, ambition.
Happened pretty much, I mean, after they abolished it, it was one thing.
Champaign, Illinois, they had a hemp works that was operating, and when the black men left, the plant had to shut down. And then in 1895, they opened up the plant in Nebraska, Fremont, Nebraska, all black men. And we were running it. I mean, we were thriving with the hemp culture. And they couldn't control it. The only way they could control it was to outlaw it. Let's say, hemp was first run in Champaign, Illinois, about 1875. A cordage mill was established there for making twine from the fiber, which was prepared in the form of long tow by a large machine blade. The cordage mill burned down, and industry was discontinued in 1902 because there was no satisfactory market for the kind of tow produced. And Nebraska hemp was first grown at Fremont in 1887 by men from Champaign, Illinois. And those were black laborers, you know, and we had the culture already under our belt. That's why, like the brother said, you know, we had no, that's what we were doing. I mean, my cousin, I think she was from North Carolina, she came to D.C. back in the 30s, back in the 40s, and she said that her grandfather and uncle was down there. They used to make rope. And I thought she was going to say that, talking about marijuana. No, it was hemp. Those were black cultures. So, no, in 1900, we were producers of it.
Uh-huh.
You know,
and then not only that, just before we're touching to the 1937 Marijuana Act, I want to talk a little bit about how during wartime, particularly World War One, and then the last time, World War Two, that there was a big resurgence to plant hemp and the use of hemp. And it seems like whenever there's war, certain laws are kind of put aside,
right,
because they need it.
Well, yeah, well, that's what they did in 19, back in the 40s, because the Japanese took over from Manila in the Philippines, so that's where they got cheap labor. It was basically a rub substitute. They used to use the abaca plant. It's a Filipino plant that's got a strong fiber, and they made rope out of it. But when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, that was over for us, so they had to go back and educate people on how to grow industrial hemp, and because they were veganized, they called it marijuana at that point, which is a racist word. It's a major racist word. So they had to come back, get their tonnage. I think it was like 65,000 tons of hemp for rope, and that's when they dropped the bomb on Hiroshima in 1945. That was horrific, you know, and I didn't know until later that that's where they grew all the sacred hemp plant, you know. It's amazing. It's amazing.
So you're saying that was part of the destruction of the hemp industry was by really targeting Japan's hemp production?
Not just Japan. We're talking about Afghanistan and Kandahar. That's where they had wildcrafted cannabis indica plants still growing just before we bombed them in 2003. And if you go to Southeast Asia, even Vietnam, there were guys who were in parachutes, came down, and they were in cannabis fields. So they just grew there. I mean, it's just there. Agent Orange was used to destroy the foliage, as a defoliant to a lot of the plants and stuff. So, it's well known in Southeast Asia. It's well known in America. But, you know, you would think that it's a foreign plant. No. This is a white racist situation that's still going on to this day. And like you said, it's
right.
Criminal. They want to put people in jail because they don't know the law.
As Brother Moore was saying, So let's talk a little bit about how, you know, they launched this campaign in the 30s. Because, you know, this was systematic. They knew what they were doing. In 1930, they released this film called We for Madness.
Right, right. Well, see, the reason why they released that is because, yeah, they had their temperance movement or the prohibition movement back in the, you know, 1920 to 1933. And they considered themselves successful. You know, you had dry states, wet states, and, you know, you had the Al Capones developed and everything. And once they finished prohibition, they actually didn't have a job after that, because what do you need the Federal Bureau of Narcotics for now? So then they focused their attention on something else: jazz, black people, Mexicans, all the people that they considered to be minorities or misfits, and they concentrated on cannabis. So Reefer Madness, they played that up, and they wanted to save American children from the problems with this new drug that was on the market, which it was already being
sold
out in
fashion.
Right, it's already medicine.
It was just stopped the moral traction.
Exactly. So they stopped manufacturing it as medicine. It stopped being prescribed as medicine in 1941. And when they did that, it was just all out there against the plant. And it just escalated, putting people in jail for life, especially in the South, any affiliation with
right.
the plant. You know, so,
right.
And that's what I said, 100 years of lynching, the 1930s, and the Reefer Madness years, and, you know, here we go. And
then we had Bill Clinton in the 90s with the Clinton drug laws, which also which set up the modern day prison day industrial complex as well.
The crack cocaine, like Reagan, you know, they created all that
Reagan.
Stuff.
Right.
Right, that's right.
I got a quick question, Nate, about, I just want you to go into a little bit more detail about the origins of the word.
The word marijuana and how they used that. And William Randolph Hearst and his involvement with this.
The Mexicans, when they came across the border in 1912, 1913, here in Arizona in the Southwest, the Mexicans were already using the plant. And they noticed that the workers, the laborers, were using something that they thought that they were, it was foreign, and it was marijuana. And again, it was associated with Mexican laborers, workers. And they used it from that point on, because marijuana is a colloquial word for Mexico. I mean, it's in South America. I mean, you know,
right.
it was never used. And you don't even find the word marijuana in the dictionary until, like, 1938. Because when they villainized it as marijuana, that wasn't in the book. You didn't hear about it. So that's why it was so, I guess, it was effective back in the 30s when they used marijuana. Reefer Madness, and they showed white people doing stupid stuff, cutting heads off and stuff. And when they did that, they were able to get it through Congress. And, you know, this marijuana was the number one drug in America. When, at one time, the number one drug was alcohol, which they call the emperor of lethal drugs.
Right.
It's the ethanol. It's the fuel. It's something that
right.
it's nefarious. I mean, they know that alcohol is changed chemical structure, going in, coming out. A sweat or anything, and it changes the fetus. Fetal alcohol syndrome. There's no medical record saying that there's a fetal marijuana syndrome. That's a medical record. There is nothing alters the fetus like alcohol does. So
right.
all of those women that want to keep drinking and get pregnant, man, that's a hard one there, you know.
Right.
Yeah, they had to bring back alcohol because it was, for 13 years, it was, you know, under wraps, and they said, no, let's bring it back. But the thing that I don't like about it is they know that alcohol is a carcinogenic. It's cancerous.
Right.
It's legal to everybody. And they have more liquor stores in the black neighborhood than any place in this country.
That's right. And then something is medicinal and beneficial, as cannabis,
and hemp is criminalized. So with the recent madness and anti-cannabis campaign in full motion, African Americans became the target.
That's right.
And so talk about how that campaign, the whole campaign around depicting black people, particularly African American men, as drug crazed, quote unquote niggers.
Well, and thank you for listening to the rebroadcast from February the 16th. This was during the Black History Month. This was our broadcast on the history, the hidden history of hemp. I want to thank you for listening, and stay tuned to us to next week. You're listening to Spiritual Roots and Earth Medicine on the Ringing Stone Network. God bless. Hotep.